Our world is at the crossroads, and our planet is in the crosshairs. We are nearing the point of no return, of overshooting the internationally agreed limit of 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming. We are at the tip of a tipping point. But it is not too late.
This is The Trust Race, a series about scandals and controversies that have impacted our trust in science. And I'm Shane Bergen. In this episode, we're going to talk about climate change, the ultimate societal challenge, one that will perhaps define the 21st century, and one that will require an all-of-humanity response. Establishing trust and expertise is going to be essential if we are to succeed. A whole-of-society response is going to be needed for us to survive climate change. And yet, scientific knowledge, great and all as that is, can often shoulder out other valid ways of knowing. Rose Roberts is a scientist and woodland Cree from the community of Stanley Mission in northern Saskatchewan in Canada, and I spoke to her about her life on the trapline and how climate change is impacting her community.
Rose Roberts in Saskatchewan. Neither school many them to smuggle people begging away and nation no charge missing John and Gerald and Saskatchewan. You got nation no simak Tristan and got Jewel me got tagged the mac. My name is Rose Roberts. I am a woodland Cree from the community of Stanley Mission in northern Saskatchewan, and I come from a trapping and harvesting family. We have had our traditional trap line for probably over 200 years. And as families, we would go to a certain area for the winter, and we would harvest the animals. And because we have spent generations in these areas of land, we know what it's supposed to look like. We know the animals that live there. We know the species of fish that live there. We know the weather patterns. One of the distinctions that the woodland Cree have from many other Indigenous peoples is that we actually have six seasons. And the other two seasons are freeze up and spring break, because in the Precambrian Shield there is a lot of water, and that was our those were our highways, right? So when the rivers and the lakes would start to freeze, we were basically isolated because we couldn't go anywhere until the ice was thick enough to travel on. And the same thing in the spring, once the weather started to warm up and the ice started to become unsafe, we would travel to what we call a spring site. And it would usually be by the mouth of a river, because the mouth of the river would open up sooner. So we still wouldn't be landlocked. We'd still have a way in and out, and we'd take a canoe there and we'd live in tents. So it was more of a spring camp. So we knew the way of the land, we knew the animals. And because I am Western trained, actually my undergraduate degree is in nursing and my master's and PhD is in community health and epidemiology. So I've always been looking at the health impact of colonization and the residential schools and all the history that has had a negative impact on Indigenous peoples in Saskatchewan and in Canada. When the government of Canada settled a class action lawsuit against the residential school survivors, everybody who had attended got a lump sum payment.
For former Chief Shane Godfredson, it's a moment to reflect and celebrate.
Very humbled and honored that we come to this resolution.
A $2.8 billion settlement between the federal government and 325 First Nations. 10 years after he first launched a class action lawsuit seeking reparations for harms done by Canada's residential school system. The announcement is actually the second settlement in the Godfredson case. This one provides reparations for the loss of language and culture as a result of residential schools.
We have a long way to go to address the poverty in our nations, and no amount of money will ever be the right amount, nor will it bring back a childhood lost. But today is about acknowledgement, about being seen and heard.
This settlement is the largest class action settlement in Canadian history. and it is believed to be one of the largest anywhere in the world. The enormity of this settlement is due to one reason and one reason only, and that is the sheer size and scope of the harm that was inflicted on the class members as a result of a cruel and discriminatory First Nations family and child welfare system.
An initial lump sum payment of $200,000 will be made to each of the 325 First Nations. $2.8 billion will be placed in a trust fund that will operate for 20 years. The fund will be governed by a board of 9 Indigenous directors.
No amount of compensation can make up for the traumas that First Nations children, families, and communities have experienced. It will support individuals who have experienced extraordinary loss and harm.
The work ahead won't be easy, says this Indigenous languages expert.
At the moment, there is not one university in Canada in which a First Nations or an Indigenous language teacher can gain credentials and gain the knowledge they need to be able to teach. There needs to be a real organized way of supporting, of being able to support the people with the proper kind of resources that are needed to do the work.
But for now, she says, this is mostly good news for Indigenous people, a view shared by Shane Godfredson.
Now it's our time to start turning, you know, our way of life around to be, you know, learn our languages and our culture. So
everybody who had attended got a lump sum payment. So one of the things that I did is for my own healing, because I'm a residential school survivor, I'm a third generation, I wanted the money to mean something. So I started asking myself, what can I do with this money so that it has an impact on me? And I started thinking about what I missed out on. So what I had missed out on was going to the trapline. I was actually granted 6 months education leave from the College of Nursing to go live on a land, because my dean at the time said, you are going there to learn Indigenous knowledge. It has just as much validity as someone going to, you know, Chapel Hill to learn qualitative research methods. I said, cool, okay, I'll take it. So I brought my mom with me and actually 2 nieces. So there was 4 of us that were there for like 10 weeks. And it was the first time that I had been there for that length of time. And there were so many things that I learned, right? And so many common sense things, you know, smack myself on the forehead because I should have known this. But what I really realized was that it is so important to connect to the land. And it was so healing for me. It brought me back to what it means to be a Nihidoshwil. And just the lifestyle, because we were walking to check our traps, walking to check our snare lines. I think I lost like 30 pounds in that 10 weeks because of the amount of physical activity that's required just to survive, right? So I started going up there for freeze up and I became a licensed trapper. I joke around that it's a good thing I have a PhD to fall back on because I'm a lousy trapper. But it provided me the opportunity to take 5 nieces and nephews with me over a period of probably 10 years when they were anywhere from 9 to 18 was the age range. And I would take my mom with me because she would not let me go there without her. There was also a program at Stanley Mission, and my sister was a teacher there. It was a land-based program. And part of that program involved getting youth to go live with families that are still on the trap line. So that 1 year, I had 2 other young women with me. So it was a really good experience for them. And, you know, I call them my trapline chicks because we develop friendships and we develop lifelong appreciation and love for each other. So that has been my experience. And of course, with mom being up there, she was the traditional knowledge keeper and the stuff that she would teach us. And there was one freeze up that my brother Jim Joe came with us. And what I began to notice is that I may have a PhD in Western education, but he has the equivalent of a PhD on Indigenous knowledge. And that one time that I really, really recognized that is that we were going across the lake, and it's a fairly wide lake and very deep. So once the wind picks up, you can get, you know, 2-3 foot swells. And we had to cross the lake. And he was able to traverse across the lake, and I did not get one drop of water in my face. And it was like, oh my God, he can read the water. He can read the waves, right? He knows this land. And my brothers want to share the knowledge that they have with whoever's interested. Because Indigenous knowledge is experiential and it's built up, right, year after year, generation after generation after generation, and the stories that are carried throughout. My mom would tell me stories as we would, you know, be going here and there. It's like, oh, your dad killed a moose here, and this is where your dad fell through the ice. And she said, I was so lonely when I saw Jim Joe paddling away in a canoe because it was so misty and we couldn't see him. He just disappeared in the fog, right? So these kinds of memories, but also at the same time, it's traditional knowledge that she's passing along and beginning to notice how it's changing. And because I'm a scientist, I guess, or a recorder of things, I would start recording the day that the lake would freeze. And the day got later and later and later, right? And then what I'd read about in terms of climate change is that it tends to produce microclimates. And this is exactly what we were seeing. That one year it froze on November 7th. And then the following year it froze on November 24th. So there was no way to try and guess when it would freeze. And then the one year it froze very quickly overnight, and then it warmed up again, which made the ice unsafe because we have to snowmobile out. It's a very remote trap line. So we fly in by a bush plane, usually the Thanksgiving long weekend here in Canada, on the last plane that goes out, and then they take them off the water because the water gets too cold. And then we have to wait till the ice is at least 3 inches thick enough to hold the weight of a snowmobile. And then my brothers will come and retrieve us. So that one year, even though it froze quickly, it didn't get cold enough for it to be thick enough. So my mom was very worried because she knew my brothers would be coming. And I said, they know, right? My brothers aren't going to cut across the lake. They're going to go around the edge, right? And they're going to stop every once in a while to check the thickness of the ice. And if it's not going to hold them, they're going to turn back. But probably in the last, I don't know, 10 years, I think it's been getting progressively worse, like the impacts. Last year, we just got dumped with so much snow and there was so much slush, right? There was a friend from Stanley who went to go to his cabin and he ended up hitting slush. And when I'm talking about deep slush, this is up to the knee level. And he tried to get his snowmobile out of the slush and he couldn't. And, you know, no matter how far you walk, he was still walking in slush. So he managed to make it to their cabin, and then it got back to Stanley that he hadn't come back. So they sent out a search party and they did manage to find him in his cabin. But by then he was so chilled, he couldn't even make a fire. So it was a close call, and there were several incidences like that last winter. And almost every year, there's at least one individual that goes through the ice. Because we just can't predict anymore. And when you think that it would be safe to travel on the ice, it's not safe to travel on the ice. So those are the things that we're starting to see when it comes to being out on the land and the trap line. The other thing is that the water level keeps on changing. It used to be, you know, at a fairly stable level, but now it's fluctuating as much as 2 feet every year. And it affects the animals, because if there's insufficient rain, there isn't going to be any berries, and then the bears aren't going to have anything to eat, right? So they're going to come closer and closer to humanity. And then if there's a, if the earth is really, really dry, and there's the fires burn hotter, and then that also kills the animals. When I was growing up, and I'm 58 now, I don't remember a time when we had to be evacuated from our community because of forest fires. And now it's like almost a yearly event. And it's disruptive to the individuals because they don't know if they're going to come home to their home.
The stories from communities like Rose's offer stark insight into the effects of climate change. As our world heats up, the knowledge and know-how of communities will surely be essential to us seeing the effects of climate change, and hopefully the effects of our responses to it. As we negotiate the complexity, it's important we embrace the full breadth of human knowledge, of our skill, and crucially, our ingenuity. Hannah Daly is a professor in sustainable energy in University College Cork, and I spoke to her about climate change from her perspective as a researcher in the area.
You know, taking a step back in the issue of climate change and understanding it and solving it takes a huge variety of different experts, and nobody is sort of, is you know, we don't have any undergraduate degree in climate change, you know, because typically we address, you know, education in disciplines. You know, you say you've got a climatologist or a geographer, you've got an engineer, you've got a political scientist, a psychologist, you know, you've got a process engineer, you've got, I don't know, a planner. And in fact, all of these disciplines and viewpoints and kind of academic perspectives are actually necessary to both understand the problem and address and implement solutions. So this is one of the really big barriers to addressing climate change, is the complexity and the broad skills and range of expertise that are necessary. And energy, the field that I'm most focused on, is a component of that. You know, so even within energy, you can simply frame the problem of addressing climate change in terms of a need for a technology transition. We need to move from these technologies and fuels, like, you know, fossil fuel cars and boilers for our homes and coal power plants, into different technologies. And that might be the kind of engineer's perspective. But you also need to understand why these technologies are not being replaced. You know, so a lot of the kind of solutions to climate change are actually more cost effective, even without thinking about the carbon emissions and the external cost of that. So to understand why maybe about 50% of the emissions savings that we need to take place are already possible with mature technologies that can bring wider societal benefits. So, you know, an engineer, just, you know, their perspective is simply, okay, there's the technology there, you know, there's something is happening to prevent that. That's why we need also the perspective of the political economists and the psychologists and marketing experts and business people to understand what are the barriers to actually transforming you know, mindsets, to transforming landscapes and laws and institutions and infrastructure that are the barriers to deploying those technologies. And of course, technology alone is not the solution. It also has to be about how we use energy and use it in a much kind of lower carbon way. So, you know, and the various players that are involved in that are, so it's not just engineers, it has to be, and I mentioned a lot of these before. The state institutions, I think, are really key players. And it's, again, not just, let's say, the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland here in Ireland, which is the kind of the authority which gives grants and tracks statistics. It is the planning laws. Are they appropriate for building offshore wind, for solar panels? It is the energy and utility regulators. Can we license and get solar farms off the ground quickly enough? Do we have enough plumbers and electricians to retrofit houses? And do they have the right skills? Do they have the right information? And it's also about, I suppose, the public consciousness about, you know, the urgency of this. And that's where the media plays a really, really strong role in explaining, I suppose, the urgency of climate change and what the solutions are.
In terms of the impact climate change is having on us and our planet, where are we at right now?
The IPCC reports, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, who are, you know, thousands of scientists who come up with synthesis reports about what the science is actually saying about the causes and the impacts and the solutions to climate change. And the sort of the really, really short, succinct answer there is it's happening. It's bad. It's us. And we can fix it.
The climate time bomb is ticking.
The message was grim, with a glimmer of hope and a call to action.
Our world needs climate action on all fronts, everything, everywhere, all at once.
Today's report by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is the culmination of years of research from around the world. Scientists say time is running out to limit human-caused global warming to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels.
We will probably reach 1.5 degrees in the first half of the next decade. The real question is whether our will to reduce emissions quickly means we reach 1.5 degrees. Maybe go a little bit over, but then come back down.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has hailed a major new report on climate change as a survival guide for humanity. Climate scientists from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said that clean energy and technology can be exploited to avoid the growing climate disaster. But they also warned a key global temperature goal will probably be missed. They say the world is expected to warm above 1.5 degrees Celsius by the early 2030s. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has been speaking at the launch of the IPCC report and said everyone needs to work together quickly to achieve the climate change goals.
The world's top climate scientists and representatives of countries have spent a week in Switzerland condensing 10,000 pages of academic research from the last 7 years into a 20-page warning for world leaders. It's a summary of all of their major reports featuring the science of climate change, current impacts of the climate crisis, and potential solutions. Some of the warnings include at least 3.3 billion people will be affected by global warming. 14% of species will face extinction if the Earth's temperature rises by 1.5 degrees, and by 2050, cities will be experiencing annual disasters that would have previously occurred every 100 years.
Leaders of developed countries must commit to reaching net zero as close as possible to 2040, the limit they should all aim to respect. This can be done.
Today's report outlines what it calls a survival guide for humanity.
This report clearly emphasizes that we do have technology and know-how and tools to solve for the climate problems.
Some of those tools are already being used.
We've seen a revolution in batteries, both small for vehicles and large for storing power from solar and wind. There's been a huge burst of innovation across all sectors.
The UN chief wants developed nations to accelerate that innovation, calling on leaders to commit to net zero greenhouse gas emissions as close to 2040 as possible.
We are at the tip of a tipping point. But it is not too late. I count on the IPCC to do what you have always done, point the way to solutions, and show the urgent need to end global heating with cold, hard facts.
So we know for sure the climate change is happening. It's caused by human activities. It's already causing kind of permanent damage to ecosystems, to livelihoods. And to, you know, it's the climate. It's something that every earth system, economic system, social system relies upon, even though we don't kind of witness it. You know, it's so fundamental to our kind of survival that we and our how things work that we don't appreciate it. It's like air that we breathe or something, and we're permanently altering it. So I mean, Homo sapiens evolved over the last number of tens of thousands of years at a time when the Earth's climate was very remarkably stable, and this post-glacial period where our civilizations evolved, it is at a time when the Earth's climate is very hospitable, not too hot, not too cold, perfect for human societies to flourish. And the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere at about 280 parts per million was very constant. And the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, it's the main greenhouse gas. It's something like a thermostat knob in the corner of a room that controls the temperature of the room. And we've now turned that knob up. We've now increased the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere to around 420 parts per million. That's an increase of about 50% since the pre-industrial age, since we've started burning fossil fuels and clearing forests for agriculture. That is now kind of beyond, far beyond the level of carbon in the atmosphere that human societies have witnessed. It's the highest in millions of years. And the really scary thing about it is there's a big lag between the carbon in the atmosphere and all these impacts you're talking about. And the problem is that globally emissions have not yet peaked. And, you know, they haven't come down, and it will only stop getting worse when CO2 emissions go to zero. So I think there's a misperception that, you know, if we kind of start going on this sort of lowering trajectory, things will start to get better. But it's actually only when we get to zero emissions that it stops getting worse. So it's a huge amount for anyone to take, and I don't blame anyone for switching off and just trying to get on with their lives, because it is, you know, you have to go through almost a process of grief and to really kind of take on board what's happening. So, you know, it's difficult to be this kind of harbinger of doom, but that is really what the facts are saying. And unfortunately, we've known this for decades. This is not new science, but the kind of the lack of political and public engagement with this is quite astonishing, really. There is starting to be a lot more political engagement, but you still see, you know, these issues being downplayed for ulterior motives, which is worrying. I think the main reason for that, and this is more gut instinct rather than something I've, you know, studied and quantified and so on, is that policymakers, both national and local councillors and so on, think that these climate measures will be unpopular. So they, you know, there's a short-term election cycle, and they have to do things that are essentially that they think are popular. I hope that they're wrong, and that the public are further ahead than they are. I'm also concerned of becoming aware that, like, the support or not for different climate measures is becoming part of a sort of a culture war. So are you one of those sort of urban greeny bike people who's taxing us and so on? You know, even if a particular measure, like, you know, local wind farms or a bike lane or putting solar panels in your schools or something, even if those will objectively bring lots of local benefits, they might align with the kind of non-climate agenda just because they don't want to align with, let's say, the green agenda, you know, and that is very worrying. Because, I mean, the thing that was very promising from the last 2 years in our Climate Act was that every political party in the Dáil voted for these carbon budgets that require very strict reductions in emissions. And when they object to the actual measures that are required to implement and to see those emissions reductions, they have to be called out. You know, they have to be, you know, they, or else they have to propose other measures which deliver the savings. But there's a whole other host of barriers as well. It's not just political. I mentioned already the various institutions that are the state institutions mainly that are required to regulate and to manage, you know, our infrastructure, mainly in our laws and our kind of the processes that we do. There's huge inertia there. Fundamentally behind all this, the status quo is just very, very powerful. Moving that around, even people's mindsets to see that what we're doing, people's day-to-day activities are what is really causing climate change. It's a very painful realization, and people want to think that it's China or it's this big companies or it's the, you know, farmers or something like that. It's everything, you know. Carbon is so integral to everything that we do. It's very difficult to change those mindsets. But the status quo are also very powerful for institutions. We have inertia in the civil service, in our laws, in the ways that we plan and build things. And it's very slow and hard to turn that around without sort of revolution, some sort of big, fast revolution. And there's also inertia in because, you know, the fossil fuel industry is it a $2-3 trillion they made profit last year? How can you kind of tell this industry, which is one of the most powerful industries in the world, that you have to either transform or go extinct? You know, it is, you know, there's this huge amount of built infrastructure communications, influence, power built into those companies. And they've clearly exerted that by denying the existence of climate change or obfuscating the narratives and pointing to false solutions.
In the future, how do you think we'll look back on this time?
I mean, it's a bit like how we look back now and think, you know, remember how people used to smoke inside pubs and it used to be normal to just come and smoke inside people's houses, or drink driving was normal, or, you know, driving kids around without seatbelts or any harness in the car. You know, we look back and think how kind of reckless that was. And, you know, I hope it can come quickly enough with this mindset that, you know, how we got our energy, we just burned it. You know, we just burn stuff to get our energy. And stuff that we know scientifically is causing this, such devastating effects. I think that it will take climate change impacts to get a lot worse before we come to that, unfortunately. But it will come to that. I think we'll just simply be shocked that we burned stuff to get energy.
Picking up from Hannah's point about our future selves being shocked that we burn stuff to get energy, why aren't we feeling that shock right now? Or if we are feeling it, why aren't we acting on it in any sort of a meaningful way? The scientific reality of climate change is clear, yet it seems that's not enough for us to collectively respond. As Hannah said, things just might have to get worse for them to get better. The question I have is, what's going to make the difference? What might help turn the tide and see us really tackle climate change? So I spoke to Heather Douglas, a philosopher of science and an associate professor at the Department of Philosophy at Michigan State University in the United States.
In the US, about a third of the US total greenhouse gas emissions come from household energy use, from the, you know, gas that's used to heat stuff, the hot water and the cook with, and electricity that's used in the household, and the cars that are run by households. If you put that together, that's about 30-32% of US greenhouse gas emissions. So that has to be tackled at the individual level, because we have to make choices about which car to buy, about changing out our gas hot water heater for a heat pump hot water heater, which I haven't done yet. I'm working on it. About getting heat pumps. I have put heat pumps in my house to try to reduce the gas dependency. But I have also a really old house. And the heat pump in a really cold climate that gets well below 20 degrees Fahrenheit, well below 10 degrees centigrade in the minus 10 centigrade in the winter. It's like cold in continental US climates. You know, even the really good heat pump, the best ducted heat pump that you can get, doesn't do it. It can't do carry all of it. So we're not there yet. But I can still lower, you know, I've managed by getting a plug-in hybrid car because the charging system isn't in there yet. So that reduced our gasoline usage by about 75%, and putting solar panels on the roof. There are things I can do. And they take lots of tons of carbon off our annual household budget. So we've reduced it by at least a third, and we're headed towards two thirds. Right? Fantastic. Is that going to be sufficient for the globe? Absolutely not. Of course not. Of course not. So it's, in many ways, it's like COVID. You have to get your own vaccine. You have to wear a mask, but you also need the communal systems that encourage masking, that encourage vaccination, that support the healthcare system, that figure out new treatments, that protect the vulnerable. There's a lot of, climate, I think, is even more complex than COVID. But there's a lot of needing both the collective communal action and the individual action. But in some ways, you can't just focus on the communal without also attending to the individual. Just as if you just focus on the individual without attending to the communal, you're going to miss the mark.
We all have individual agency, right? What can we do with that in order for us to change our own lives, but in order for us to encourage the collective response to climate as well?
Oh, that's a really good question. So I think it's actually, for me, I've had fun thinking about how would I decarbonize my household? I think the other thing that needs attention is the local level of policy making. And this is where it gets really hard and also really boring. So, you know, what are the rules that govern your local utility? Are they good rules? Are they being incentivized to do the right kinds of things? How easy is it to put rooftop solar on? What are the connection charges? What's the backup? What kind of, is it net metering or something less, you know, less good? What are the building codes, right? These sorts of rules govern a lot of the communal stuff, but wow, is it boring and nitty gritty and localized? Like it's, you know, state level or county level or city level stuff. And that's where the communal effort really has to come into play. The good news is, I mean, this is why I think that has to happen. Right now, the cheapest new form of electricity generation is renewable. Right? The levelized cost of solar and wind are cheaper than anything that's fossil fuel driven. Electric vehicles over the lifetime of their use are going to be cheaper than any internal combustion engine, right? Because of the lower repair costs and lower fuel costs. And that more than swamps the upfront initial cost. So why aren't we seeing, you know, why are people still building natural gas plants to generate electricity? Why are they still pushing, you know, internal combustion engine cars? A lot of policies. Where are the chargers? What are the chargers going to charge per kilowatt hour electricity? If it's not coming out of your garage, if you don't have a garage, if you live in a condo, an apartment building, what are the rules about charging cars in, you know, apartment buildings and condos where you are? Then we're at a much, you know, sort of, that's where all the speed bumps are. And at that level, we have to pay attention. And it's really hard because nobody wants to think about it. But if you get, we get this right, I mean, just thinking about the shift to electric vehicles, where charging happens in parking lots and garages, either communal garages or individual garages. We have all these gas stations that we get to decommission. What are we gonna do with that space? It's often in prime locations in cities. What gets to happen to that wonderful space? So there are real opportunities that might motivate us to actually pay attention to the details going forward.
Climate change is complex, and so are the controversies and scandals therein. Our responses to climate change are setting us on course for a disaster. Policies excessively focus on people taking individual action as if that's going to solve the issue. Large polluters are unchallenged as they greenwash, deny basic scientific realities, and seed doubt around climate change and our need to respond. A recent London Science Museum sponsorship deal with a major oil firm included a gag clause. The museum incredibly agreed to take care not to say anything that could damage the firm's reputation. These scandals represent failures of leadership on many, many levels. And without leadership and a sense of solidarity, it will be impossible for us to meaningfully respond to climate change. And so I wonder how things might be different. Might we embrace the power of community to change the narrative? Might citizens' assemblies that hear expert views and lived experiences offer hope? Through talking and listening, can we find the common ground and establish the trust we so desperately need? The clock's ticking. The trust race is underway.
Our world is at the crossroads, and our planet is in the crosshairs. We are nearing the point of no return, of overshooting the internationally agreed limit of 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming. We are at the tip of a tipping point, but it is not too late.
The Trust Race is supported by Peritia, an EU-funded project investigating public trust and expertise. grant number 870883. This series is produced by Sean and Morris. And you can find me on Twitter at Shane D. Bergen.